than today, much dustier for starters. There was a council of big-brain wizards in the city of Rakotis on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. To Michael's great annoyance, the man seemed unable to tell the story without indulging in any number of digressions on topics as diverse as the varieties of edible fruits, the intelligence of camels, the stupidity of birds, and his own astonishing amiability. Along with all this, he made repeated offers for Michael and Gabriel to share his supply of beetles, offers that Michael and Gabriel always declined while pressing him to get to the point. "And these big-brain wizards decided it would be a wonderful idea to write down their greatest, most terrible, most secret secrets, the ones that concern the very making of the world. In the end, they created three books." The man held up two fingers. "One dealt with time, one with life, and one with death. And they were locked away in separate vaults below the city, which really was a lovely city." There followed a disquisition on the many charms of Rakotis, till a growl from Gabriel prompted him to continue. "Then the big brains, in their braininess, created an order of guardians who were sworn to protect the books with their lives. There were only 10 guardians at any one time, but they were versed in both magical and non-magical combat and were supported by the power of the wizards." He scratched his beard. "Time passed. The big brains grew soft and were perhaps not quite so big as they once had been. This is where Bert enters the story. He was a young guardian, bright-eyed, zealous, amiable. Oh, my!"
"Skip that part," Michael said.
"And then everything changed."
The man leaped up and began pacing back and forth, waving his arms about violently. Michael and Gabriel moved in front of Emma so the man didn't strike her by accident.
"It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining. Bert was atop the watchtower. Out of nowhere, 1,000 ships materialized off the coast. Fire filled the sky. Dragons appeared in the east of the city. Sand trolls attacked from the south. It was Alexander, the boy conqueror, and the big brains were doomed. Alexander was too strong, had too many dark wizards in his army. It was up to Bert and his brothers to get the books out of the city. But by the time they reached the vaults, only the Chronicle remained. The other two books were already gone."
The man's mind seemed to drift off. He stood, stroking his beard and murmuring,
"Not Bert's fault. Did his best. Can't fault old Bert,"
until Michael called him back.
"In the end, only 4 guardians escaped the city. The rest died in the fighting. The survivors fled south to the bottom of the world. There were elves living here in the ice and snow. At first, Bert liked them. He should have known better."
"Why?" Michael asked. "What do the elves do?" The man didn't answer. He was caught up in his story.
"Bert and the others tapped into the power of the book. The valley became lush. They gained long life. They hid the Chronicle anew and built this fortress. More time passed, century upon century. They had a scrying bowl that showed the outside world. So many changes. But though they searched and searched, they saw no traces of the 2 missing books."
The bearded, wild-eyed man faced them, grinning.
"But they learned of the prophecy. The keepers of the books would appear. They would bring the books together once again. Bert convinced the others it was their duty to guard the Chronicle until its keeper arrived. Then...
His energy abruptly ran out. He slumped onto the tower wall. Michael and Gabriel had to wait several moments for him to continue.
"Men are not meant to live for thousands of years. The minds of the strongest become dry and brittle. One of Bert's brothers decided that he was the Chronicle's keeper, and Bert and the others were keeping it from him. Brother slew brother. Oh, murder! Oh, treachery! The blood! Terrible! Terrible!"
He covered his face with his beard and spoke through the matted hair.
"Bert's false brother was finally slain. But then only Bert and one other remained. Not enough to defend the Chronicle. Bert's last brother ventured forth in an attempt to find the true keeper. Poor, brave soul. Poor Bert. All alone."
And the man began bawling once more. Michael glanced at Gabriel. They were thinking the same thing. The other guardian, the one who had left, had to have been the skeleton that Michael and Dr. Pym had discovered in Malpessa.
"So, where'd the dragon come from?"
Michael asked.
"And what did the elves do that you don't trust them? And would you please stop crying?"
The man dropped his beard and laughed, slapping his knees in joy.
"Yes, yes, the elves. It was when Bert was alone that the elves showed their true colours, tried to steal the book. But they didn't know that Bert and his brothers had bought a dragon's egg from Rakotis. Bert hatched it in the heat of the volcano, bonded it to the Chronicle, when the elves marched on to the fortress. Well..."
"Ho, ho, ho," Michael chuckled. "I'll bet they weren't expecting that." Then he saw Gabriel scowling and dropped the smile.
"And that,"
the man clapped his hands, apparently pleased with himself,
"is that. Now,"
he leaned forward, peering at Michael,
"tell Bert the truth. Have you come for the book?"
"Well,
yes." "Ah, knew it. But the real question, the big question..."
The man came closer, his breath rasping through his beard. He placed a trembling hand on Michael's shoulder.
"Are you the keeper? The one Bert has been waiting and waiting for?"
Past the dirt and matted hair, the man's face was unlined. Only his eyes betrayed his age. They were eyes that had lived with one single purpose for nearly 3,000 years. They were asking, "Is it over? Is it finally over?" They were the saddest eyes Michael had ever seen.
"Are you the keeper?"
It should have been a simple question to answer. Michael had been told he was the Chronicle's keeper by Dr. Pym, and then he'd felt the book calling to him through the snowstorm. Still, saying it, acknowledging it, was somehow different. But there was no hiding from the eyes. He said, in a whisper,
"Yes, I am."
The madman nodded and took his hand from Michael's shoulder.
"I suppose we'll soon see, won't we?"
What do you mean?"
"You want to restore your sister, yes? The screaming shin-kicker."
"Of course."
"And you've seen the forest. That was once ice and snow. What do you think called it to life? The Chronicle. It will revive your sister, awaken the life sleeping within her. It is the only way."
"Then let us waste no more time," Gabriel said, and started for the stairs. "We know it is in the volcano."
"No!"
The man jumped to block him.
"The dragon will kill you."
"But don't you control the dragon?" Michael demanded. "You said you hatched it from an egg."
"No, no, no. The dragon doesn't obey Bert. The dragon serves the Chronicle. Bert is suffered to live because Bert serves the same purpose, however."
Once again, he leaned close to Michael.
"The Chronicle is hidden in the volcano, yes. And the dragon will kill any who enter, even Bert. But the true keeper can pass unharmed."
He gripped Michael's shoulder.
"To save your sister, you must go into the volcano and face the dragon alone.
Chapter 13. Hello, Rabbit. Not surprisingly, Gabriel wanted to go in Michael's place. He said that the Guardian's warnings were meaningless.
Why should we take the word of a madman who eats beetles as candy?
Says him, muttered the Guardian. He hasn't tried them.
At the very least, we should go together.
They were still atop the tower. Emma was still frozen. Only the sky had changed, softening from inky black to a deep dark blue. Michael held firm.
We can't both go. What if we're killed? There'd be no one to look after Emma, and if you went alone and got killed, I couldn't carry her out of here. I have to go, and you have to stay. That's all there is to it.
And if the dragon doesn't obey you?
Gabriel said.
What then?
He means, Michael thought, what if I'm killed?
Then you take Emma to Dr. Pym.
Let us go and find the wizard now, and return when your sister is well. There is no need to take such a risk as this.
Michael shook his head. They had no way of knowing what had happened in Malpessa after they'd left. What if Dr. Pym had only slowed Rourke down? The bald man could already be on the trail of the Chronicle. Michael had been willing to risk abandoning the book when there was no other way of saving Emma, but now getting the book also seemed to be the surest, fastest way of waking up his sister. It was a chance they had to take, even if it meant Michael going into the volcano alone. And, after all, he'd figured out the potions in Malpessa. He could do this. In the end, Michael won, as he was right, and Gabriel knew it. Gabriel knelt and pulled a knife from his belt. He said it had been a gift from Robbie MacLauer, the king of the dwarves near Cambridge Falls. The blade was a foot long and surprisingly light, and would cut through bone as easily as paper. It would also, both Michael and Gabriel knew, be useless against a dragon. Still, Michael thanked him and tucked it into his own belt. He felt better for having dwarf steel at his side.
We have a saying among my people.
Gabriel laid a heavy hand upon his shoulder.
A man can die only once.
Michael wondered if this was supposed to be encouraging.
I guess that's good to know.
You remember that first morning in my cabin after I saved you from the wolves?
Yes.
You had betrayed your sister to the Countess in hopes that she would help you find your parents. Do you remember?
Michael stared at the ground. Did he remember? The memory haunted him. It was the single worst thing he'd ever done. By his own weakness and stupidity, he'd nearly lost what was most important to him, the love of his sisters. He couldn't think of it without pain, and yet, in the 8 months since Cambridge Falls, Michael had replayed what he'd done over and over, hating and cursing himself, and ending always with the promise that he'd never let Kate and Emma down again, no matter what.
Look at me.
Michael raised his eyes to Gabriel's.
Each day, by our actions, we decide who we are. You are no longer that boy. Your sisters are fortunate to have you as a brother, and it is an honor for me to call you a friend.
Michael's throat was too thick to speak. He could only nod his thanks. Then, wiping his eyes, Michael hugged his sister, crushing her thin arms against her sides, whispering,
I'll be back soon,
and turned and followed the last guardian down the stairs. In the large ground-floor chamber, Michael stared at the mouth of the tunnel, while the guardian turned a crank fixed to one of the columns. A chain clanked, and the iron gate began to rise.
She'll know you're coming.
She? The dragon's a girl?
Oh, yes. Now you'll be safe as long as you're the true keeper. She serves the book, and the book serves the keeper.
Okay.
If you're not the true keeper, she'll most likely eat you.
Okay.
She might roast you first.
Okay.
Or just gobble you up.
I got it. The gate was up. Michael stood there, feeling the heat wash over him. Don't close the gate, he said, and started down the stairs. It was just as in his dream, the long tunnel, the red glow in the distance, the brutal, throat-scorching heat. The difference being, this was no dream, and Michael knew what lay ahead. The tunnel had turned a few yards past the gate, and now ran straight on and down. The porous black rock was warm to the touch, and there was a sulphury sourness to the air. At first Michael kept his feet moving with thoughts of Emma, frozen atop the tower. But with each step, the pull of the Chronicle became stronger, and soon it alone was drawing him on. Then the tunnel began to climb, and there was a new smell, one Michael had never encountered, and he could think only that it was the stench of dragon. Knowing he was close, Michael knelt down and, with trembling hands, pulled out the dwarf omnibus. There were several passages where G.G. Greenleaf had written about dragons, and Michael quickly found the relevant sections. Dragons are notable for their lust for gold, not a bad quality taken in moderation. Dragons are immune to fire, obviously. All dragons are terrifically vain. Indeed, as to who is more vain, a dragon or an elf, I would not want to be the one to decide. Hint? An elf. A dragon should never be engaged in conversation, as they are inveterate liars and tricksters, though if you're actually talking to a dragon, you're pretty much toast anyway. Never, ever call a dragon a worm, no matter how much they're asking for it. Michael snapped the book shut. He did not feel any better. He was about to rise when his thumb felt the stiff edge of the photo that Hugo Algernon had given him. He pulled it out, and there was his father, smiling up at him from deep in the past. Michael felt a hard knot of sadness in his chest. Would he ever actually meet his father? Would the day ever come when they would sit down, as Michael had often imagined, and talk about their love of all things dwarfish? When his father would tell Michael how proud he was of him, crouching there in the reeking, sweltering cave, yards from a dragon's lair, Michael thought that day seemed very, very far away. Michael slipped the photo into the book and then, on a whim, flipped through and opened to a different page. In the spring of that year, the goblin hordes marched into dwarfish lands, burning and pillaging everything in their path. King Killin Killick raised an army and rode out to meet the monsters. A young squire, riding alongside the king, asked what was the secret to his long and successful reign. King Killick replied, "A great leader lives not in his heart, but in his head." It was a quote that Hugo Algernon had said his father loved. It was the quote that Michael loved and tried to live by. He read on. "Emotions cloud the issue," the king explained. "The one who can see most clearly will always triumph." Unfortunately, the day was fine, and Killick had chosen to ride without his helmet, and just then a goblin leaped from a tree and split his noble head in two. But let us take comfort that though the goblins routed the army, razed the countryside, and renamed Killick's capital Goblin Town, showing thereby their typical goblin flair with names, the great king's words live on and are a lesson to us all. Michael closed the book and stood, feeling fortified. He slid the omnibus into his bag, making room for it beside the gold circlet he'd taken from the sculpture of the elf girl. He adjusted his glasses. "It's time," he told himself. 27 nervous steps later, he entered the cavern. Gabriel stood atop the tower. He had cleaned the mud from Emma's cheeks and the last bits of fern from her hair. He couldn't stop wondering if he'd done the right thing in letting Michael go into the volcano alone. Would the wizard have approved? After all this time, had he made a mistake when it mattered most? 15 years earlier, Gabriel had almost died while fighting in Cambridge Falls. King Robbie MacLauer's dwarves had found him and saved his life. Later, while he'd been recuperating in his village, the wizard Stanislaus Pym had come to see him. He'd told Gabriel about the Dire Magnus and his hunger for the Books of Beginning and what it meant for the children.
"The enemy knows the children will lead him to the books. He will hunt them."
It had been autumn, the air cool and crisp, and Gabriel had just begun walking without crutches. The wizard had gone on.
"Our only hope lies in finding the books first. I will do all I can, but I need someone strong at my side, someone who cares about the children."
Gabriel had been about to answer that he could depend on him, but the wizard had laid a hand on his arm.
"Understand what I'm asking. A war has begun. It will go on for years to come, and I will need you every day of that time. For all your strength, you are a man with a man's span of years. This is the time you would find a wife, start a family, know what you would be giving up."
Standing there, in the forest above his village, Gabriel had thought of the life that could be his. Then he'd thought of Kate, Michael, and Emma. Especially of Emma, who had touched his heart in a way he'd never thought possible.
"You're sure that finding the books will keep the children safe?"
"Yes."
"Then I am yours to command."
He had never once regretted his decision. His only fear had been that he would somehow fail in his duty, and it was with that in mind that he turned to go down into the volcano to seek out Michael and help however he could, when a crushing blow struck him across the back of the head. The cavern was roughly circular in shape, perhaps 50 feet across, with a ceiling that rose into darkness and a large pool of lava that occupied most of the cavern floor. A narrow ring of black rock ran around the base of the walls. On the far side of the pool, Michael could make out the mouth of another tunnel. There was no dragon to be seen. Michael stepped to the edge of the pool, his eyes watering from the heat and fumes. He stared down at the bubbling surface and thought, "You've got to be kidding." The book's pull was stronger than ever, and the source was, without question, within the pool of lava. The Order had put the book in a pool of lava. He almost couldn't believe it. Indeed, he wouldn't have believed it if the force pulling at him hadn't been so strong, and he had to admit it made a crazy sort of sense. Assuming the lava didn't damage the book, which had to be the case, the Guardians must have planned for the molten rock to serve as a final line of defense. "Great," Michael thought, "but how am I supposed to get it out?" He started looking around for a long stick.
"Hello, rabbit."
Michael stumbled backward, tripping, skinning the heel of his hand on the rocky floor. A deep, feline chuckle echoed around the cavern walls.
"My, what a clumsy little rabbit you are."
Michael jerked his gaze upward. He had an idea where the voice was coming from, and he could just make out a large silhouette against the darker rock of the ceiling. The dragon was hanging upside down like a bat.
"Stay where you are! Don't come down here!"
"The rabbit comes into my home and starts giving me orders. Where did you learn your manners? Also, you have a very funny nose. I can see it from here."
This last was undoubtedly a strange thing for a dragon to say, but Michael was scrambling to his feet and didn't notice. He'd had time now to take several deep breaths and remind himself that the dragon had to obey his commands, and as his initial panic subsided, a phrase of G.G. Greenleaf's came back to him. "Dragons are immune to fire." In a flash, Michael realized how he was going to get the Chronicle, the dragon, was going to get it for him. Good old G.G., Michael thought. Always there when you need him. You're right, he said, softening his tone. I'm sorry. You just surprised me, was all. I should introduce myself. My name is Michael P. Wibberley.
P. Wibberley. What an odd name.
No, just Wibberley, no P.
Well, Michael, just Wibberley, it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. I don't get many visitors.
Really? Michael said. It's their loss. He was gaining more confidence with each second, and indeed felt that he was carrying himself remarkably well. Look at me, he thought, just standing here talking to a dragon. He decided that after he got the chronicle, he would have the dragon pose for a picture with him. He glanced around for a rock on which he could prop the Polaroid.
Thank you, Michael, just Wibberley. I want you to know that I'm going to remember how polite you were after I've eaten you.
Michael said, excuse me?
I said, I'm going to remember how polite you were after I've eaten you. That is the plan, you know.
Don't panic, Michael told himself. It doesn't know you're the keeper. I'm afraid, he was trying to maintain his confident tone, you can't eat me.
Aren't you the cutest rabbit? But you're wrong. I can, and I will, and I must. I don't really have much choice in the matter.
Michael heard the sound of iron-hard nails scraping on rock, the metallic slithering of scales. The great lizard was uncoiling itself from the ceiling. Michael felt suddenly incredibly small. The idea arced across his mind that perhaps Gabriel had followed him into the tunnel and would now leap out to protect him. Don't be silly, he thought. You're alone. Gabriel wanted to come and you told him not to. Your own fault for being such a top-notch debater. Just stay focused. Listen, dragon. It was time to adopt a sterner tone, such as one might use with a willful puppy. There'll be no eating me, you hear? You can't. So, just put that out of your head. I'm the keeper.
The what?
The keeper. I'm the keeper of the chronicle. That's why I'm here. You're supposed to get it for me.
Really?
The dragon seemed genuinely surprised. Yes, I need it to help my sister.
That was your sister I snatched from the clearing? I thought I noticed a family resemblance, though she seems to have escaped the tragedy of your nose. Now, do you prefer to be eaten raw, or should I roast you a little first?
But you have to do what I say. The man, the guardian, he said so. Laughter rolled about the cavern.
That man and his lies. Let me ask you something, rabbit. Did he tell you what happened to the other members of the Order? Did he say why he's alone here, with only me for company?
Michael's neck was starting to get sore from staring upward. That's neither here nor there, he said irritably. Just hop down and get me the chronicle. Then we'll take a quick picture.
Did he tell you how he became convinced the chronicle was his, and then murdered two of his comrades in the dead of night?
Michael didn't move. Despite the cavern's overpowering heat, he felt a chill settle upon him. That's not what happened.
Oh, it is, I assure you. Only one of his comrades managed to escape, and my master has long feared that he will return with allies to claim the book. That, of course, is where I come in, to help him defend his blood-drenched prize.
No. One of the other guardians went crazy, and you're here to protect the Chronicle from the elves. That's why he hatched you. The Order! They brought an egg all the way from Rakotis. He told us.
Michael commanded himself to remain firm and not fall for the dragon's tricks, though it didn't help that the creature's laughter was filling the cavern.
Protect the book from the elves? Why would the elves want some silly old book? And he didn't hatch me from any egg, I'll tell you that.
The dragon became strangely somber.
But you are right. The elves will not trouble him. Would you like to know why?
I'm not interested in more of your lies, the dragon murmured.
Those bad manners again.
But went on as if Michael had asked to hear the story.
You see, Rabbit, after killing and driving off his comrades, my master was not in his right mind. He saw enemies everywhere, and the elves were close by and strong. He convinced himself that they coveted his treasure. So, one day, he surprised the elf princess in the forest. It is her kingdom at the far end of the valley. He tricked her, placed a curse upon her, and has kept her captive ever since. You will not see her, but she is here. The elves do not dare attack.
And they didn't even want the book?
No. So my foolish master is safe from an enemy that was not an enemy, and his treasure is safe from a people who never wanted it. Is that not madness? And now he's tricked you into coming here. Poor doomed rabbit.
You're lying. That's what dragons do. They lie.
Well, let's do a little test, shall we? Give me an order, and let's see if I have to obey it. This will be fun.
Michael was beginning not to like this very much. He wanted to get the book and be done. He decided he would forego the photo.
I'm waiting, Rabbit. Give me an order.
Go. Go get me the Chronicle.
No.
I said, Michael was trying and failing to keep the panic from his voice, go get the Chronicle.
I heard you the first time, Rabbit. No need to shout.
So, go get it.
You go get it.
Stop it.
Stop what? Stop going to get the Chronicle or stop talking?
Stop talking! The dragon laughed.
You're very cute when you're angry.
Michael was trembling all over. His fists were clenched tight and his eyes burned with tears of frustration. It couldn't be true, it just couldn't.
But
why would he lie? Why send you down here? From what I gather, I can't read his thoughts exactly, but I do feel what he's feeling. We're connected, you see. He's nervous about a companion of yours, some big strapping fellow, and wanted to put you both at your ease. So he had you meet Bert.
But he's Bert, isn't he?
Michael could see the shadowy form of the dragon moving across the ceiling. The creature was even larger than he remembered.
Yes, and no. He's also Zanbertis, murderer and oathbreaker, and he wants me to kill you.
So I'll ask again, and please stop looking toward the tunnel. You're not going anywhere. Do you prefer to be eaten alive or roasted? I say roasted, less to clean up after.
Michael heard a growl that he was almost sure came from the creature's belly.
Listen, he stammered. Don't do anything rash.
As he spoke, Michael's hand was rummaging in his bag, searching for anything that might convince the dragon not to eat him. His fingers fumbled with his pocket knife, compass, camera, the dwarf omnibus, the badge proclaiming him royal guardian of all dwarfish traditions and history, all useless, all worthless.
If you're being held here against your will, I have a friend who's a very powerful wizard.
Running was pointless. The dragon would catch him in an instant, but there had to be something, anything.
Wait! I'll give you this!
Michael's hand had closed around the golden circlet he'd taken from the sculpture of the elf girl. It wasn't much. Indeed, it was very little with which to bargain for his life, but it was all he had. And G.G. Greenleaf had said that dragons suffered from gold lust, and G.G. Greenleaf had never been wrong. Even so, Michael was unprepared for what happened next. The moment the crown cleared his bag, the dragon gave a roar so fierce it was like a wind striking Michael's body. He saw a blur of gold fly toward him, a flash of fangs and claws. Michael turned away in terror. Without thinking, and this was the action that no doubt saved his life, he held the golden circlet out over the pool of lava.
"I'll drop it!"
The dragon landed a foot behind him, the impact shuddering through the rock. Michael could feel the creature's breath, like the hot blast of a furnace, crinkling the hair at the back of his neck. Up close, the dragon smelled of burnt metal and sulphur, and something else that Michael couldn't place, almost like perfume. For a long moment, neither boy nor dragon moved or spoke.
"So, drop it,"
the dragon said finally.
"I don't care."
"Yes, you do."
Everything about Michael, his hands, his legs, his voice, was shaking terribly. "The lava will melt it in a second. I'll drop it, and you'll never get it."
"Do that," the dragon said, "and I'll kill you."
"Aren't you going to kill me anyway?"
"True, but since you have to die, at least give me the crown. Don't be a poor loser."
Michael's arm was already growing tired. He looked down and saw one great talon only inches from his right foot. To Michael's surprise, there was a gold band, almost like a bracelet, clasped tight around the dragon's foreleg. Was that why it wanted the circlet so badly? So it would have a matching set? G.G. Greenleaf was right. Dragons were certainly vain creatures.
"Come now, rabbit. Give me the crown, and I promise to make the roasting very quick and even."
"Wait. I want to see the Chronicle. I've come a long way. If I'm going to die, I want to see it at least once. You have to give me that."
"And then you'll give me the circlet?"
"Yes."
"You swear?"
"Yes."
"What will you swear on? What's most important to you?"
"My sisters," Michael said without hesitation. "I'll swear on them."
"Then, rabbit, we have a deal."
Michael heard the rasp of talons pushing off rock, and he turned to see the dragon launch itself into the air. For an instant, it hung above the pool, its golden scales reflecting the red glow from the lava, leathery wings outspread, armored tail whipping this way and that, and Michael gasped, for the creature was, despite all its fearsomeness, stunningly beautiful. Then the dragon dove and disappeared, seal-like, into the bubbling lake.
Michael dropped the circlet onto the rocky floor and ran. He ran as he had never run before and never would again. Indeed, in that strip of tunnel between the dragon's lair and the fortress, Michael Wibberley, who had never won a single race in school, who was always picked last for every team, and then only if the other team accepted some handicap, like having a turtle play first base, for that brief stretch was the fastest boy in the world. For all the good it did him. Rounding the last corner, he stopped dead in his tracks, staring in horror. The gate over the mouth of the tunnel was closed. Michael threw himself against the bars.
"Gabriel! Gabriel!"
A pair of boots hurried down the steps into view.
"What are you still doing alive?"
Michael felt all his strength desert him. The guardian stood on the other side of the gate. In every way but one, the man looked exactly as he had when Michael had first seen him atop the tower. The same mismatched rags, the same wild hair and beard. The single difference was that Michael could discern not a trace of madness in his face. There was only a gleeful, greedy triumph. The man brandished a wooden club.
"That friend of yours had a very thick skull. I had to give him 3 hard taps before he finally stayed down. Now, where is that dragon?"
Just then there was a shriek of fury from deep inside the mountain. The guardian smiled at Michael and chuckled.
"Oh? Oh?
Let me out. Please, let me out. She'll kill me. You..."
The man's hand shot through the gate, seizing Michael's shirt.
"Boy, the Chronicle is mine. I've guarded it for nearly 3,000 years. For its sake, I've taken the blood of those I loved most in the world. Neither you nor any other will ever have it. You understand? Never!"
He leaned closer, staring into Michael's terrified face.
"I always wondered who my old comrade would send against me. I've imagined wizards, warrior elves, troops of armored dwarves marching here to steal my treasure. And, after all this time, he sends a pair of children. You were his great champions."
The man began cackling, and Michael found himself revising downward his opinion of the man's sanity. He could hear the dragon's footsteps thundering closer.
"You know something?" Michael said. "You're an idiot."
The man stopped laughing.
"What?"
That was all he managed before Gabriel, who had been creeping silently up behind the man, cracked him across the head with the butt of his falchion. And then Michael was shouting, his words a panic jumble of dragon and gate and hurry, please. And Gabriel was staggering up the stairs, turning so that Michael saw the blood covering the side of his face and head. And there was a crackling in the tunnel, the sound of air catching fire, and the gate began to lift slowly, slowly. And Michael was crawling under it, yanking free the strap of his bag as it caught on one of the spikes, feeling the ground beneath him start to tremble. And then he was through, scrambling over the body of the guardian, shouting, "Close it! Close it!" and sprinting up the stairs as an echoing roar told him the dragon had rounded the last corner. To Michael's surprise, the creature did not crash into the gate. It did not rend and tear the metal in a fury to reach him. Michael lay on the stone floor of the chamber, gasping for air, his heart racing, listening to the sound of the dragon breathing just inside the mouth of the tunnel. And then the dragon laughed.
"Rabbit, you really are making things very difficult. If you weren't so cute, I'd almost be angry. I suppose you know this gate is enchanted. Otherwise, I'd have torn it apart long ago."
"Of course,"
Michael panted. He'd known no such thing.
"Unfortunately, even though my master is unconscious, his order to kill you still holds. And you don't really think that after 200 years I haven't found another way out of the volcano, do you?
Michael was up instantly. He could hear the dragon racing back down the tunnel. Gabriel, we... But Gabriel was unconscious on the floor, the wounds he'd received from the Guardian having taken their toll. After checking to make sure that his friend was breathing, Michael raced for the tower stairs. He had no plan. All he knew was that he had to get to Emma. As he climbed, he cursed himself for going into the volcano. He'd been stupid, arrogant. It was Cambridge Falls all over. He thought he was smarter than everyone else, but he wasn't. And now his sister would pay the price. The fact that he would die as well never entered Michael's mind. He only knew that he had let down Emma and let down Kate again. As Michael emerged from the stairs into the open air, he saw Emma exactly as he'd left her, motionless and staring into space. There was a shriek from above, and Michael spun about and saw the dragon, red streams of lava dripping from its wings, erupt from the mouth of the volcano. The dragon turned, a creature of fire, burning against the blue-black sky, and, with an eerie, graceful slowness, dropped down the side of the mountain. Michael seized Emma in his arms and struggled with her stiff body to the stairs, managing only a few awkward steps before he tripped and the two of them rolled in a tangle to the landing below. Michael's nose was bleeding, his whole body was bruised and banged, and he was kneeling over Emma repeating, "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry," as the top of the tower was suddenly ripped away. Michael looked up and saw the dragon banking in the air to come back for another pass. He threw himself across his sister, but the dragon didn't ram the tower. It hovered there, using its great tail as a mace to knock away the remaining stones. In moments, the stairway was open to the sky, and Michael felt the dragon settle upon the wall. Something landed beside his feet.
"There, Rabbit! I promised you a look at the Chronicle, and I keep my promises."
Michael leaped up, putting himself between the dragon and Emma, and drew the knife Gabriel had given him. Though it was crouched on all fours, the dragon still towered above him, all armored muscle and claw and fang. Michael was nothing next to it, not even a rabbit, but he stood his ground, even as his legs shook beneath him. The dragon regarded him through narrow eyes, the color of blood.
"I really don't want to eat you, Rabbit. In another life, I think we could have been friends, but I can't disobey the will of my master."
"I'm not," Michael stammered, "I'm not afraid of you."
"Yes, you are, but you're trying not to be, and that's what matters. Because of that, I'll give you one free tickle with your needle before killing you. Come closer."
Michael took one trembling step forward. He could feel the heat coming off the creature's body. The dragon was right. He was scared, but also angry. It shouldn't be ending this way. He and Emma separated from Kate. Emma not able to fight for herself. Him all alone.
"You don't know anything,"
he shouted, tears now streaming down his cheeks. "You don't know anything about us, me and my sisters, why we're doing this. You're just
a stupid worm." "That's it, Rabbit. Let your anger flow. Your death will be so quick you won't even know it. Strike!"
The dragon's breath was steaming Michael's glasses, but as he raised the knife above his head, he saw, once again, the golden bracelet around the dragon's foreleg. It stopped him. If the bracelet was gold, shouldn't it have melted in the lava? Unless, Michael thought, the bracelet was enchanted in some way, just as the iron gate had been enchanted. Suddenly, the song the elves had sung in the clearing came back to him. "For deep below that nasty hide, there's a princess hiding still. Please come back, oh, please come back. Change your gold band for this one. The dragon had said that a curse had been put on the elf princess, and the guardian had said the dragon was a girl. But was it possible? Was it actually possible? Strike, rabbit, now, strike! There was no more time to think. Michael swung down with all his might. He felt the knife cut neatly through the golden band and into the dragon's leg. The dragon shrieked in rage and reared up, claws raking the sky. Michael closed his eyes and waited for the talons to rip through him. I was wrong. I'm dead. Emma's dead. I've killed us both. And he was aware of an enormous crushing sadness, greater than any fear of death, because he knew that he had failed his sisters. Then he heard a sound like a moan, and something struck the landing. Michael opened his eyes. The dragon was gone. In its place, a golden-haired elf girl, the living, breathing image of the sculpture in the clearing, lay amid the ruins of the tower. A severed bracelet was beside her, and beside that, a glowing red book. Well, Michael thought, look at that. And then he collapsed. Chapter 14. The Hothouse.
Separation. That's their word for it. Surrender is more like it. Cowardly. Base. We are lions fleeing before rats. Nature revolts at the very idea. Cigar?
Rourke produced a leather case from inside his fur coat and flipped open the top, displaying four cigars lined up like missiles. The carriage was rumbling along the cobblestone streets, and Rourke, sitting across from Kate, had stretched out his great legs so that his feet rested on the seat beside her. He seemed a man very much at his ease.
No, thank you, Kate managed.
Well, sick to my stomach it makes me, and that's no lie.
Rourke bit off the end of his cigar and spat the nub out the window with such force that it knocked off the hat of a passer-by. He chuckled and lit a match with his thumb. Soon sweet cigar smoke filled the carriage.
I'm not denying that something had to be done. How the non-magical vermin have been multiplying, the abuse and oppression of our kind. But nature teaches the rule of the strong. Let me tell you a story. Do you know Ireland at all?
Kate gave a small shake of her head.
My home, it is, and a beautiful and tragic place. I grew up in an orphanage outside Dublin, run by the Sisters of Sweet and Enduring Charity. Never knew my parents, though I was told that my mother was half-giant, which is not difficult to believe, given the eye-boggling size of me. As it was, I was regarded as a freak, a thing not wholly human, and treated accordingly.
Kate said nothing. She was only half-listening. She was searching through her pockets. It had to be there. She couldn't have lost it.
By the tender age of 9... I was larger than any man in Dublin, and was sold by the good sisters to a fellow who owned a quarry. He chained my leg to a spike, and I spent 12 hours a day hammering big stones into smaller stones. But I wasn't yet finished growing, was I? Got bigger and stronger every day. Finally, my own master came to fear me. Indeed, so great was his fear, he plotted to kill me. Luckily, I discovered his sanguinary intentions, broke free, and, with the very hammer he gave me, smashed that empty head of his to pieces. Ah, a great day that was, dark and bloody and beautiful.
He smiled at the memory and exhaled a cloud of smoke.
Sure, I was caught easy, too stupid to run, and sentenced to hang as soon as rope could be found strong enough to hold me. But the night before the sentence was to be carried out, I'm sitting alone in my cell, and suddenly I'm not alone. He's there with me.
The man leaned forward eagerly.
And what did he say? Declan Rourke, you are not human. Their laws cannot condemn you. If I free you, will you serve me faithfully? And how did I respond? Brother, says I, if you get me out of here, I'll clean the mud from your boots. And didn't he take me away and make me the man I am? Open my eyes, gave me power, a great, great man. And now, lass,
the bald giant smiled, leaning back,
you're about to meet him.
The carriage passed through a pair of iron gates and into the courtyard of a large four-story mansion, set in the middle of a block of mansions. An imp stepped forward and opened the door. Rourke peered at Kate through the smoke.
You all right, lass? You do look awful pale.
I lost something, Kate said. It was in my pocket.
And what was it? I'll send an imp back to search for it. Must have fallen out when we collided.
Kate imagined one of the imps picking up her mother's locket, touching it. She realized she'd rather never see it again.
It's not important.
In that case,
he gestured with his cigar,
my master awaits.
We're not blaming you.
You should,
Abigail cried, pointing a finger at the two boys.
Ain't they the ones that threw those snowballs? Hadn't been for that, those kids never would have chased us, and the imps never would have gotten her. It's their fault.
Beatles and Jake were both uncharacteristically quiet. They stood side by side, twisting their caps in their hands. They were gathered in the belfry atop the church, arrayed in a line before Henrietta Burke's desk. Rafe stood to the side. The old magician Scruggs, wrapped as always in his shabby brown cloak, sat against one of the pillars. The sun was low in the sky, a dull smudge visible through the clouds. It would soon be dark.
And it was definitely Rourke who took her,
Henrietta Burke asked.
It was him, Beatles said quietly. There ain't no mistaking him. They put her in a carriage and took her to their mansion uptown. We followed them, ran the whole 20 blocks behind the carriage.
Yeah, you're a couple of real heroes, Abigail sneered.
Enough, Henrietta Burke said. You children can go. Abigail, Jake, and Beatles headed toward the trap door. The boys paused at the top of the ladder and looked back at Rafe.
We didn't mean nothing to happen, Jake said. We liked her.
Yeah, Beatles said. We're real, real sorry.
Rafe nodded. He was clenching something in his right hand. As soon as the boys were gone, he turned to Henrietta Burke.
I'm going to get her.
The woman shook her head.
She was never our responsibility, and now that is doubly so. Didn't you hear? She got caught trying to protect them. We all, our duty is to those here. All day there have been reports of human mobs attacking magical folk. The humans sense that something is happening. I need you here. The separation is only hours away. The girl is on her own. No!
Henrietta Burke had already gone back to her papers, but now she looked up sharply. Even Scruggs, who had been chewing his fingernails, took notice.
Excuse me?
Rafe stepped close to the desk. His voice, his whole body, was trembling with emotion.
Scruggs's spell keeps the church hidden. You don't need me. You just don't want me going there. Ever since the imps showed up, you've tried to keep me clear of them. Why?
Because there is nothing to be gained by feuding. That ain't it. I know Rourke's looking for me.
How do you know that?
It ain't important. Tell me what he wants.
Henrietta Burke stared at him. Her face gave away nothing. Finally, she said,
It is not Rourke who hunts you. He is merely the right hand. It is his master, a being whose power is beyond any of us. Whoever he is, if he needs something from me, I can bargain. I can get him to give up the girl. He will never give up the girl, and if you enter that mansion, you will not emerge from it.
Then her grey eyes appeared to soften.
I know you want to save her, but you cannot sacrifice yourself.
What aren't you telling me? The boy struck the desk. What do they want from me?
Henrietta Burke glanced at Scruggs, looked back at the boy, and shook her head. Rafe stepped away.
Fine, but I'm going to get her.
Why?
What is it between you and this girl? Why would you risk so much?
For a moment, Rafe was silent. He was no longer trembling. He opened his hand and glanced at the golden locket Beatles had given him. The boys had picked it up from the sidewalk after Kate had been taken. He said,
"You have your secrets. I have mine."
He'd started to turn when Scruggs spoke.
"Wait!"
The old magician shuffled to his feet.
"There is a way to save her and still escape. You just have to enter without being seen."
Kate had expected to be taken to the Dire Magnus immediately, but after entering the mansion with Rourke, she found herself engulfed in a flurry of activity. Imps in their shirt sleeves were moving about furniture, carrying crates of champagne, iced platters of salmon and oysters, large bouquets of flowers. There were small, wizen-faced creatures, gnomes, Kate learned, polishing floors, cleaning windows, spitting on and wiping down anything brass.
"We're having a bit of a do tonight," Rourke said as he led Kate up a wide set of stairs. "You certainly picked the right time to drop in."
Still gripping her arm, he led her through a pair of double doors and into a ballroom. Kate had only ever been in one ballroom, the one in the mansion in Cambridge Falls, and this one dwarfed the other. The floor was a shining expanse of blonde wood. To the right, French doors gave onto a balcony that looked out over the street. To Kate's left, a wall of mirrors reflected the snowy scene outdoors. Red cushioned chairs.